Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LIII, Rome Welcomes Hadrian. In the last episode of Emperors of Rome, we looked at the youth of Hadrian and how he managed to become emperor after the death of his adopted father, Trajan. So far, so good, but Hadrian now has a massive problem. What to do with Parthia? He can't exactly ignore it, and then there are those in Rome who look like they're going to move against him. Life as the emperor is always going to be a bit tricky, so Hadrian has to make his move, and he has to do it quickly. Here's Rhiannon Evans. After taking a bit of a scenic route, when Hadrian returns to Rome, what kind of reception is he met with?
Hadrian seems to have been met with potential rivals because one of his first acts, as far as we can tell, is to get rid of some people, some consulars. It's known as the Affair of the Four Consulars, which means they were ex-consuls. And there are lots of different versions of what happened here. Dio tells us that four men were executed, or murdered rather, he uses that word, called Palma, Celsus, Nigrinus, and Lucius. But it does seem as though Hadrian later wants to deny any responsibility for this. So presumably they're seen as rivals or people who might threaten his power, because as we've seen, Hadrian's rise to power may have been carried out in dubious circumstances. These people may have been a threat to him. But it's bad press for him. And this has sort of always been the case. If the first thing you do is to execute senators, aristocrats, elites, then it'll be used against you by historians. Certainly in the past, it's something that Tacitus picks on.
So I assume that there would have been charges of conspiracy, whether real or trumped up kind of charges.
If he did have a reason, then he didn't go through proper processes, according to the wording used by Dio, because he doesn't say executed. He doesn't say tried and found guilty. He says murdered.
Right.
So somebody was ordered to go in and get rid of them. And remember that usually if you were found guilty of a capital charge for Romans and you were an elite, and these are ex-consuls, so they are elite, they'd have been asked to kill themselves. They would have been asked to suicide. And they weren't. They were murdered. They were killed by somebody else, which is the worst thing that can happen to you as an elite Roman, to have the decision about your death taken from you. So the implication is that this was not done in the correct way. They didn't go through a trial. They were just got rid of. And certainly Hadrian seems to have worked to distance himself from their deaths. He says that it was carried out by somebody else in his autobiography, which we don't have, but it gets mentioned by the Historia Augusta. It's mentioned that he said it was the Senate who carried this out without his input.
He actually blames Atianus, which is his former guardian.
Yes.
Who potentially had something to do with him coming to power.
Yes.
So and it all gets very Days of Our Lives.
It does seem quite soapy, doesn't it? I think that looks like Hadrian did have a hand in it, but he's trying to shift the blame onto somebody who had a lot of influence and authority over him. Perhaps he was persuaded to do it by Atianus. Can't know.
Yeah.
But it may well be that. And then he feels guilty about it, or he feels like that could be used as bad press against him. And certainly the sources, the Historia Augusta in particular, talk a lot about how he tries to not quite make up for this, to distance himself from that act, but then to assure people that it's not the kind of thing he does. So he makes a public oath that he won't kill senators.
That's good. because this would have really worried the other senators, wouldn't it? It would have thought, oh no, do we have a tyrant? Do we have a Domitian here?
Yeah. And it's a public oath as well, something that everybody knows about and can see.
Yeah, so it's a good thing in some ways that he got that out of the way at the start of his reign so he can...
Well, not good for those four, I guess, but...
definitely not good for those four. So that's the first impression that he gives to the Senate. How about to the people of Rome? What does he do to kind of show them, hey, new regime, come along with the message I'm trying to send?
Well, in a way, what he's sending is a message of continuity, but even better days to come. So he increases what's called the alimenta, which is basically welfare to the children of the poor. But the word alimenta means food. So it's providing for them.
Mm.
And he gives lots of donatives to both the army and the people. So he's making himself popular by the traditional means. And he's implying that this will be Trajan, but perhaps even better. Although, as we know, you can't get better than Trajan. He's also responsible for getting rid of people's debt. So actually burning their debts and doing this in a very public way in the forum, which is seen on coinage. So he's basically saying this is a blank slate to people who have any debts. And of course, this is a way of gaining popularity because we want lower taxes and no debts. And it was the same in antiquity.
So one of the first acts that Hadrian does as being the emperor is to mess with what Trajan left behind. He saw that map of 117 of going, this is the full extent of the Roman Empire, and said, we need to make changes. We're too big for our own boots.
It seems so. It's kind of cemented Trajan as the emperor who ruled over the greatest extent of the Roman Empire ever. It's Hadrian who did that for him because immediately he wants to lose some of the very recently gained territory in the east. So Mesopotamia, basically.
Was that giving them too much trouble to hold on to, was it?
Yes, it was too difficult. It was much better in the hands of local princes, nobles, who were in some way beholden to Rome, which of course is a traditional way for Rome to have influence and authority anyway. These places which are distant, powerful, rich are always dangerous in terms of conspiracy. So if you put Roman troops there, if you put Roman governors there, there's a potential for fomenting dissent and conspiracy. So that may have played a part. But a lot of ancient historians feel that this is stretching the empire too far, that that's one of the reasons the resources are going too far, that it actually made sense to draw it back in. And also, Hadrian is doing something that is very traditional. So you could look at Hadrian and say, oh, you know, he's giving up what his adopted father did, his great achievements. But in a way, he's doing what Augustus did, which was to make sure that the borders were firm. And Augustus sort of laid out boundaries by rivers in a way. And one of them was the Euphrates. And Trajan had gone beyond the Euphrates. He'd also gone beyond the Rhine in a way, or beyond the Danube anyway, by going to Dacia. By going beyond the Euphrates, he'd sort of broken that Augustan rule. Hadrian brings it back to the Augustan rule.
Okay. But this is the first serious seceding of territory that's ever happened in the history of the Roman Empire, isn't it?
Mm. But it happens so soon that they don't have any firm provinces there at that point. So it's not as if, it's not what happens much, much later when the Roman Empire really starts to collapse. And for example, they give up Britannia, which has been a province for hundreds of years. This is very, very recent. So it hasn't been formed into any kind of stable province yet.
So what is it left as then?
There are different designations for Armenia and Mesopotamia, but basically it comes down to client kings.
Okay.
Yeah. So you've still got a lot of influence. You still get to determine who's in charge. And of course, you get favorable policies. These people are not going to, they're not going to fight against Rome.
Mm.
But you don't have to be as involved in the organization as you do with a province.
It's quite a setback for a Roman emperor to start his reign on. The first thing that he's going to do is become the first emperor ever to lose territory.
It doesn't seem to have affected him. There's no negative press for that. There's negative press for Hadrian from our sources, but not particularly for that.
Yeah.
I think that was seen as common sense.
To get rid of that territory.
Yes.
Okay.
And it also fits with what Hadrian does later, which is literally firming up the boundaries. So he is an emperor who does that. He's not interested in continued warfare. He's interested in stability.
So Hadrian then spends the next 2 years, 1117, 1118, traveling back to Rome, the scenic route. So he's now emperor. Where's he going and why is he taking his time?
He doesn't need to take nearly that long. Travel in the ancient world was slow, but not that slow.
Mm.
It doesn't need to take him 2 years. He could have got on a boat and it would have been a lot quicker. He clearly is very deliberately surveying the provinces. So he's going, as you say, the long way around through Syria and eastern provinces in what we think of as now Turkey, so like Bithynia and Pontus. And it literally, if you look at a map, it is a kind of curve around to the east and the north, and then through what we now think of as northern Greece, Thrace, Switzerland, Austria area, southern Germany, Pannonia, and back down into Italy. So he's some kind of skirting around the empire and then back down. And it must be to survey the provinces, survey at least part of his territory. And it's also an early sign that he is going to be a traveling emperor. He's going to go on other journeys too, even bigger ones.
Yeah. Being an emperor from Italica, what did Hadrian look like? Did he look like the Spanish people that we know from Spain today? Did he have that kind of complexion? Would it have been similar to Trajan, who he's closely related to? What do we know about what he looked like?
We don't know much about emperor's complexion unless it's written about. And he doesn't seem to look much like Trajan, although he is, as we know, distantly related to him. We know about Hadrian's appearance mostly through statues and through coinage, which is true of most of the emperors, except we used to have descriptions in Suetonius up until Domitian. We don't have Suetonius anymore, so we don't get that little paragraph near the end where he says, gives us a kind of roundup of what the emperor looked like.
It was always a strange tangent because it was like, right, they're dead. Now this is what they look like. It was, yeah.
Yeah, that is the Suetonian formula, which we're not getting so much, even though we've now got a biography of Hadrian, which we didn't have for Nerva and Trajan. It doesn't do the same kind of job for that. But always the main way we know what emperors looked like is through material culture that remains. Obviously, we have to be a bit careful with that because it's often idealized, officially approved in terms of its look. But the interesting thing about Hadrian, which certainly was true because he always has this, is that he's quite different from previous emperors in that he has a beard. So that's a big difference. No previous emperor has had facial hair. Mm. And this is some kind of statement that Hadrian's making, and it relates to that accusation of him being a little Greek, because what he's going for very clearly is the Greek philosopher look. So this is, if you see bust statues of Greek philosophers in museums that have ancient portraiture, they'll always have a bust of Socrates or somebody who's supposed to be Socrates and other Greek philosophers. And the kind of full beard that Hadrian has is clearly modelling himself on that. So he's laying out his credentials as somebody who knows about Greek culture, somebody who's fluent in that and actually wants to model himself on that look.
Why did the Romans in particular like the beard, or why weren't emperors sporting beards before Hadrian? Because he really kind of set the trend, didn't he? After Hadrian, beards were the fashion, beards were the go.
Well, Romans don't seem to have had beards on the whole. I mean, it's very hard to generalize. But the very, very early Romans are often portrayed bearded. But then throughout most of the Republic, they're clean shaven. That's kind of their look, short hair and clean shaven,
yeah,
at least in terms of the Roman elite. But from Hadrian onwards, it is the look for the emperor.
Was it a fashion trend that we can maybe attribute to him?
Absolutely. Yeah. And not fashion in the way that we think of fashion, that it changes every year, because it lasts a whole century,
yeah,
at least. It's not until we start to get a lot of emperors very, very quickly in around the 230s in the 3rd century that we start to get some variety. But even then, some of them have beards. So it's a fashion that lasts a long time. And it's probably helped by the fact that, and this is looking ahead a little, coming up in a few emperors' time, we're going to have Marcus Aurelius, who actually wrote philosophy in Greek. So, of course, he's happy to take on that mantle. It's something that is kept up by emperors. It becomes their new look, their kind of their new mark for at least 100 years.
There's a line of thought that when you look at Hadrian's statues, and stay with me here, Rhiannon, that there's a lateral crease in the earlobes of the statue, and cardiologists have looked at that and said, well, people who have that have a tendency towards heart disease. There's a chance that Hadrian had a tendency towards heart disease, or the person making the statue just really had lousy technique. How good were they at statue work?
Well, they're very, very realistic, aren't they?
Down to the earlobe crease?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And if it's something particularly, I suppose if it was something that a sculptor could show off about, that they could actually incorporate that, then it might have originally been there. Especially perhaps because in the time of Hadrian, there's a kind of new classicism. So in other words, there's a harking back to the kind of style of Augustus, not in terms of the beard, but in terms of the look of the portraits themselves, the very smooth skin, the very beautiful appearance of members of the imperial family. And of course, that's harking back to classical Athens. So the tendency is to have smooth skin. And if they've marked something in that seems to disrupt that, then it might have indeed been originally there.
Okay, an actual feature. The Augustan histories in some ways tried to ape the style of Suetonius. So does it tell us anything at all about his appearance?
Only in terms of the general slew of negatives about Hadrian, because it seems to hate Hadrian. So there is a comment that he's blemished in various ways. It starts fairly positively. He was tall of stature and elegant in appearance. His hair was curled on a comb. We know he had very curly hair. And he wore a full beard to cover up the natural blemishes on his face. And he was very strongly built.
So the beard was a literal beard?
Yeah, that's what they're suggesting, that it was a cover-up in the way that we still use the word beard metaphorically. We have no way of knowing that, and it's the only source that talks about it. That's the Augustan history, chapter 26 of his life. It may be so, but as I say, it's so relentlessly negative about Hadrian. It could just be, oh, he's got a beard. There's obviously something he's trying to cover up. And remember, the Augustan history was probably written in the 4th century, so not by people who had direct contact with Hadrian, who'd been able to see him, perhaps with his beard off. But then how would they know? It would have to be rumour, wouldn't it? Because certainly in adult life, he always has the beard.
Yeah. That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. Please leave a review there and tell your friends about it. You can like this podcast on Facebook. And both myself and Rhiannon Evans are on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I am at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we begin to follow Hadrian on his long and scenic tour as he begins to travel around the Roman Empire. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You have been fantastic, and thanks for listening. Shout out to Eddie Izzard. Hi, Eddie.
Hello to Eddie Izzard. I feel a bit nervous about that somehow. He does talk about ancient Rome quite a bit in his act.
Does he?
I did go and see him in Melbourne last time he was here.
Did you really?
Yeah. And I went to the Q&A afterwards. I half thought about saying, I know you talk about ancient Rome sometimes and I've got this podcast. But I didn't.